The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Declaration of Independence, when it speaks of the laws of nature, is hearkening back to a tradition of natural right, which holds that there are certain rights that are pre-political and that we enter into government for the protection of those rights. Now, there's another tradition of natural law that sees rights as grounded in reason. Personally, those terms, while they mean much to people who ascribe to them, they are not shared by everybody. That is why the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights preferred to speak of rights that are deeply grounded in the world's major philosophical and religious traditions.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 3rd, 2019. Marianne Glendon is the chair of the Commission on Unalienable Rights, announced by Secretary Pompeo on July 8th to great controversy. The commission was charged with examining the basis of human rights claims and the extent to which they are or are not rooted in the American rights tradition. The response of the human rights community was swift and fierce. A lot of skepticism, a lot of anger, a lot of criticism. Marianne Glendon, the chair of the commission and the learned hand professor of law at the Harvard Law School, sat down with Jack Goldsmith to discuss the commission, what it is and isn't looking at, and why examining the root bases of human rights claims is a worthwhile endeavor for a State Department commission. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 440, Marianne Glendon on Unalienable Rights.
I'm here with my colleague, Marianne Glendon. Marianne, thanks for chatting with me today.
Thank you.
You are the chair of Secretary of State Pompeo's Commission on Unalienable Rights. What is that and what are you charged with doing?
The committee's main charge is to try to make sense of all the confusion that currently surrounds the concept of rights, and to do so in such a way as to be useful to the people who have the challenging task of transforming principles into policy.
So you're talking about people inside the government?
That is correct.
So this is really a committee, I'm just trying to understand, that is set up really to help the Secretary of State. You're supposed to advise him, am I right about that?
That's correct. And of course, the State Department does have a very busy, hardworking department that deals with human rights, among other things. But as the Secretary indicated in announcing the commission, there comes a time when you have to step back from the hurly-burly of the day's events and think about in terms of where we came from with human rights and foreign policy, where we are now, and where we ought to be heading.
So that's why, for example, this commission is set up separate from the Bureau on Human Rights and Labor.
Yes, but we will be interacting with them consistently, and part of our role will be to advise them. I think the reason why the commission was created just now, and why the commission, in my view, is overdue, is that we are in a moment when the very idea of human rights is in crisis. It is being attacked from the right and the left. There is confusion about what rights are, why we have them. And meanwhile, About half of the world's population is suffering under regimes where they have no rights at all. Not the most basic rights that are the preconditions to all other rights.
And so the idea of rights that are the precondition of all other rights, is that your focus?
No, I would say that's one focus.
Okay. So just to push on that a little bit, there was a sharp reaction to the creation of this commission, to put it mildly, by a lot of groups that I will say are sort of proclaimed guardians of human rights. That's my description, not yours. Certain civil society groups, certain law professor groups, UN actors and the like. And so I want to come back to that reaction. But before, why is it important to get these definitions right? Why is it important to define and articulate human rights properly?
Well, as a professor, I have to start with Socrates, that the definition of terms is the beginning of wisdom, that you can't really think or communicate without defining terms. But where foreign policy is concerned, it is simply a fact that human rights discourse has become the lingua franca for cross-cultural, cross-national discussions about human dignity, human freedom, and it's important that the parties to those discussions are not just talking past each other, but at least understand the tools they are using.
But who gets to decide these things? I mean, the idea, the very idea of human rights, as in part the sharp reaction to your commission implies, is contested. And so who gets to decide, and where does your commission fit in?
Those questions about the definition of human rights, their scope, their limits, their foundations, the way they relate to one another, those are all questions that are, as you pointed out, they are not simple, and there really is a time when somebody has to sit down and think systematically about them. It's been 70 years since the UN had two commissions thinking systematically and worldwide about those problems, and a lot has changed. And so it's a good moment to take that task up again. What strikes me about the controversy is that people seem to think that the commission has already reached conclusions about matters that they've been charged to try to figure out.
And that's not the case.
And that is not the case.
And yet, there were some hints, at least, or there... Some people have picked up on the language and some of the descriptions of the commission as an indicator of the direction you're going in. The original notice for the commission that suggested that it would focus on how human rights discourse, quote, has departed from our nation's founding principles of natural law and natural rights, unquote. And those phrases, natural law and natural rights, scared a lot of people who think they're code for a view of rights that they don't like, or a view of, basically, I'd say that, a view of rights that they don't share. And by the time the commission was announced, the natural rights language was no longer in the commission's description, and instead you used the phrase unalienable rights. So I guess my first question is, that since that's your focus, what is an unalienable right?
Well, that term unalienable is, of course, meant to evoke the language of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are endowed with certain unalienable rights, that they include life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But it's also meant to evoke the distinctive rights tradition of the United States that flows out of the Declaration and down through the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the many ways in which people like Abraham Lincoln and the women who fought for suffrage and Martin Luther King called us to an ever fuller embrace of that tradition and those rights.
So does that mean, I think in the description of the commission, there was a focus on unalienable rights, and there was an emphasis on the American tradition, and there was also an emphasis on the Universal Declaration. So is that, so let's just stay on the first part. Is part of the somewhat narrower, perhaps, focus of your commission on the American tradition alone? And how does that fit into the part of the description that's about the tradition articulated in the 1948 Universal Declaration, which you wrote a great book about?
Well, our charge is both to ground our deliberations in the distinctive rights tradition of the United States It would be natural for the United States in framing foreign policy to ground itself in our rights tradition. But we also, as a nation, made certain commitments, especially in the period right after World War II, in our charge as people who are going to advise the Secretary and the Department on rights and foreign policy, we have to pay serious attention to those international commitments. I'll give you a fun fact about unalienable. That word was not Jefferson's original word. Jefferson said inalienable, as we tend to do today. But when the draft went to the printer apparently took it upon himself to conform the spelling to what the printer thought was common usage of the day.
Do we know why? Do you know if it was common usage of the day?
I don't know, but...
So we don't know if the printer or Jefferson got it wrong?
So right? We, for purposes of this commission, we adopted the language of the Declaration,
Right, that's interesting. So staying on inalienable rights, Secretary Pompeo, I can't remember if it was in an op-ed about the commission or in the introduction to the commission himself, he distinguished between unalienable rights and what he called ad hoc rights granted by governments. He said that the former unalienable rights were by nature universal, and is distinguished those from rights granted by government. So there seems to be a distinction there, and it makes it sound to me, and I'm wondering if this is right, whether your project will be in part about defining a narrow set of core rights that are in some sense foundational and held by human beings independent and prior to their recognition by governments. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Well, I would say it's fair to describe our work as beginning by going back to basics. And in this case, the basics are the founding principles of the United States and the principles in the Universal Declaration. That would be the beginning.
But is there, can you say more, maybe you can't, about maybe this is part of what you're trying to figure out, of this distinction between unalienable rights and those recognized by governments?
One of the things that I hope we will do is to bring some clarity into the different ways the term rights is used, and to come up with distinctions that at least make sense to most people who are concerned about these issues.
Okay. And do you have a view on how do unalienable rights, as he described them, differ from natural rights? Do you have a view about that? Is that something, I mean, do you as the head of the commission have a view about that? Is that something you're going to figure out?
My view is that the Declaration of Independence, when it speaks of the laws of nature, is hearkening back to a tradition of natural right, which holds that there are certain rights that are pre-political and that we enter into government for the protection of those rights. Now, there's another tradition of natural law that sees rights as grounded in reason. Personally, I think that those terms, while they mean much to people who ascribe to them, they are not shared by everybody. And so that is why the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights preferred to speak of rights that are deeply grounded in the world's major philosophical and religious traditions. Especially when you're thinking worldwide with many countries outside the West, I think that for this purpose is a more widely understandable way of speaking about universality.
Okay. It seems like one interpretation I have of your commission is that it is grounded in a reaction to expressing a concern about what might be called rights inflation or rights proliferation. This is not a new concern. It's been a concern for a long time now. It's not a concern. I mean, it's a concern that you've expressed in more than one book, actually, in various ways. But it's also a concern expressed by thinkers from across the ideological spectrum, including, I think, progressive thinkers like Honora O'Neill and Michael Sandel. Is that a frame for this commission?
I would say that's one of the topics that the commission will discuss. I would see it as one of many phenomena, and this list won't be exclusive, one of many phenomena that are fueling skepticism about the very concept of rights. Another such would be the disappointing performance of international institutions that are charged with some responsibilities for protecting rights. Another would be the sense in many non-Western countries and in fragile states that Western-funded organizations are imposing neo-colonial views on them and calling them human rights.
So I'm trying to figure out how you're going to go about addressing these topics. Secretary Pompeo said that the commission members will address basic questions, and these are his words. What are our fundamental freedoms? Why do we have them? Who or what grants these rights? How do we know if a claim of human rights is true? What happens when rights conflict? Should certain categories of rights be inextricably linked to other rights? That sounds to me enormously ambitious. It sounds like a life's work and very hard. And it seems like the answers will be invariably contested. So how are you going to answer these questions? How are you going to approach your work?
I think you're right that it's an immensely challenging assignment, but it's precisely because there is so much misunderstanding and confusion about all those questions that it was a good idea to create a commission at this time. And since we haven't even had our first meeting, we're still in the organizational stage, but all I can say is that I have great confidence in the remarkable group of men and women who've been asked to tackle them.
So it's more from Secretary Pompeo trying to flesh out, as you understand it, the meaning of his understanding of the commission. He said that international institutions designed and built to protect human rights have drifted from their original mission. And he said, and I'm quoting him here again, as I just did, we must be vigilant that human rights discourse not be corrupted or hijacked or used for dubious or malignant purposes. In your short statement when he introduced the commission on the announcement of your appointment, you said, and I'm quoting you now, basic human rights are being misunderstood by many and manipulated by many. Can you tell us, you said you've hinted at this a little bit already, but can you explain what that drift is, how rights discourse has been hijacked and manipulated?
Yes, but first I would like to give you the full quote,
okay,
which
good.
Is
Please.
That human rights are being misunderstood, manipulated, and ignored by the world's worst human rights violators.
Good, I'm glad you said that.
The press left that one off. But that last point is huge for me personally. We must never lose sight of the fact that half of the world's population, 4 billion and some people, are living under authoritarian regimes where they do not have basic human rights. As to why the drift happened, ironically, I would say the drift is a byproduct of the great successes of the post-World War II human rights project. After the human rights idea showed its power in the movements that ended apartheid in South Africa, brought down totalitarian regimes in Eastern Europe, after all that happened, there began to be a surge of interest on the part of many groups to have their agenda items characterized as universal human rights. So we see a certain drift away from the basic concepts and declaration.
Using my terms, the idea was this was a successful movement. It was successful for a reason. And some institutions, some groups have come along and are trying to use the currency of the success for ends that you think aren't served by the original project. Is that the right way to think about it?
Well, very little is known about the funding and agendas of many of these groups that have described themselves as human rights groups. I think back, all of this was predicted by my old philosophy professor at the University of Chicago, Richard McKeon, who was a member of the UNESCO Commission on Theoretical Foundations of Human Rights. And McKeon said, there's always going to be a danger that the provisions of this declaration will be used for purposes other than what was intended.
And indeed, Pompeo said, I think maybe he was talking about what you just described, he said and I'm quoting him, "loose talk of rights unmoors us from the principles of liberal democracy." What is that? What is that idea?
There, I think the secretary was getting at the idea that in a liberal democracy, and especially in our American liberal democracy, our freedoms are protected not only by rights, but by institutions that make rights possible. So limited constitutional government, the rule of law, and mechanisms that give the citizens a say in setting the conditions under which we live and work and raise our children.
So maybe then, another quote from Pompeo, maybe this is closer to what you were getting at a second ago, but then you can tell me if I'm wrong. He said, rights claims are often aimed more at rewarding interest groups and dividing humanity into subgroups. What does that mean? Do you think that's accurate, and what does that mean?
I think he packed a lot into some short sentences.
Let me say it again, because I fear I mumbled it. Rights claims are often aimed more at rewarding interest groups and dividing humanity into subgroups.
I think what he was getting at there were the risks of departing from the idea of rights that inhere in each human being in favor of an idea that rights inhere in members of a group as members of a group. And the risks of that, of course, are sowing political divisions and, even worse, conveying the destructive message that rights are merely a function of who exercises power at the moment. If you insist that your policy preferences are universal rights, that tends to remove debatable issues from democratic debate.
Okay, I want to move on to talk about the members of the commission, the composition of the commission. Based on that composition, one critic said that the commission, which includes scholars of different faiths, looks designed more like an interfaith commission than one created to study the subject of human rights. So can you say a little bit about the membership on the commission, and what do you think about that characterization of it?
I find that such an odd way of describing a commission that includes experts on human rights, on European and American history, international law, political theory. It includes Republicans, independents, and Democrats. I just wonder what the critic would like to see. Does he think there's something wrong with the fact that these people, these wonderful scholars, also are of diverse religious beliefs? Or does he think religion should be excluded?
Will the commission, there's been a lot of concern expressed that the commission is going to focus on the religious foundation of rights. Maybe it'll have a particular emphasis on religious freedom. I mean, do you know yet?
Well, of course. If they would take the trouble to look at the principal documents of the U.S. rights tradition, and if they would take the trouble to read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, they would see that religious freedom is, in fact, mentioned in those traditions. So it would be odd if we did not discuss that among many other rights.
And what do you say to the widely voiced fear that the commission is really about deplatforming certain rights such as abortion and gay and trans rights?
I would suggest that they read the charter of the commission, that they read the secretary's announcement of the commission, and instead of indulging in wild speculation about what the commission is going to do. The commission is a study group. It's an independent study group. And it's been directed to focus on principles and not policies or specific issues.
So, as I recall, your great book on the Universal Declaration made the point that in 1948, at least, the West was open to the idea of economic and social rights, at least as understood at the time and conceived in a certain way, and that that wasn't just some crazy plot by the communists or the Soviet Union. Although soon after the Universal Declaration was published, you also explain in your book, the political and civil rights on one side became divided from the social and economic rights on the other, and that divide began to track the Cold War fight between the West and the Soviets. This is a very important topic. You've also stated in another place, and I'm quoting you here, "I regret very much that over the past 50 years, those provisions," I think you were talking about social and economic
yes.
rights, "have been neglected." This is still quoting you. "The Universal Declaration did well to affirm that respect for human dignity requires not only political and civil rights, but also attention to the basic needs of every man, woman, and child in the world." So that's a powerful statement. That's not a statement that resonates in certain slice of the modern human rights movement. And it's not often discussed, especially as much. Well, I won't characterize how and where it's discussed. Will economic and social rights have a place in your commission?
Yes, they are major principles, as you just stated. They're major principles in the Universal Declaration. And in the Declaration, they are made interdependent with the political and civil rights.
Can you explain that idea? Your book also talked about that. What does it mean for the political and civil rights to be interdependent with or integrated with economic and social rights? I think the idea, but you can fix it for me, is you can't have one without the other, and they're co...
You know, I think it's helpful to think of the New Deal, and it's helpful to think of the preambles to some of our great statutes in the United States dealing with housing and other matters, where we speak of rights to a decent home, rights to minimal subsistence for those who need it. The Universal Declaration says that the political and civil rights and the social and economic rights are interdependent, but in Article 22 of the Universal Declaration, I have to get technical here, in Article 22, which is kind of a mini preamble to the social and economic rights, it states very clearly that these rights are to be implemented according to the political organization and the material resources of each state. That means that specifically rejected the Soviet insistence that the social and economic rights were to be exclusively guaranteed by the state. Instead, it adopted the United States position, as explained by Mrs. Roosevelt, that these rights would be brought to life according to the political organization of the various nation states, and they could compete in excellence in providing a good society where all of the interdependent rights were respected. It's interesting that Eleanor Roosevelt further commented about the Soviet position that gave priority to the state. She said, "No one has figured out how to do this without an unacceptable loss of freedom."
That's great. But what were you bemoaning when you said in that quote a second ago that you regret that over the past 50 years, the social and economic rights provisions have been neglected?
Well, I think that that sharp division between the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and the United States led many people, and I still hear this today, many people in the United States to think that those social and economic rights were the brainchild of the Soviet Union. Quite the contrary, the Soviet Union abstained from the final vote because they couldn't get their way with the state being the guarantor. So what I think that resonates with our American tradition is something like the way in which those two halves of the Declaration represent the divided soul of liberalism, our love of freedom, and our sense of being part of a community where we all bear a certain responsibility for one another. It's interesting, I'll just add one more thing on here. Many people at the time of the drafting of the Declaration thought that the word obligation rather than rights would have been better here. Somehow, I think Norway, for example, might have been on the right track when it said, "It's an obligation of the state to care for the neediest." That resonates with many philosophical and religious traditions.
Great. So picking up, just going back to something you said just a second ago, I want to quote again from your book on the Universal Declaration, where you said that the Declaration's message was, and here I'm quoting, that the rights, assume you mean in the Declaration, have conditions, that everyone's rights are importantly dependent on respect for the rights of others and on the rule of law and on a healthy civil society. And you also said that one of the remarkable features of the Declaration, and I'm quoting again, was its attention to the small places where people first learn about their rights and how to exercise them responsibly: families, schools, workplaces, and religious and other associations. And you went on to say that these little seedbeds of character and competence, together with the rule of law, political freedoms, social security, and international cooperation, are all part of the Declaration's dynamic ecology of freedom. That's the end of the quote. So do you think that contemporary human rights have departed from that important vision of the Universal Declaration?
Well, I like to think the idea, the noble ideal, still lives, but I also think that our seedbeds of civic virtue are not in the best of condition. And in fact, it's my view that we have a social environmental crisis that is every bit as serious as the crisis in our natural ecology. And that's a concern because, as Mrs. Roosevelt said, human rights begin in the small places. And the judge for whom my chair is named, Learned Hand, said, "The spirit of liberty will die if it doesn't live in the hearts of people."
Right. So I think that statement, the earlier statement about everyone's rights are importantly dependent on respect for the rights of others, on the rule of law, and on a healthy civil society, is a very important statement for understanding our times. So critics, the commission has been criticized because as hypocritical. Your commission has been criticized as hypocritical because the current president has a harsh immigration policy. He cozies up to dictators. He attacks democratic institutions. And he, in some respects, it is said, has eroded human rights commitments and practices of the United States. Does this criticism concern you, and how at all does it relate to your work?
I think anyone who has those concerns should be glad that the U.S. State Department has set up a commission that will help the U.S. improve its understanding of rights and the way it incorporates them into foreign policy.
Do you think that human rights have relevance for domestic politics and immigration politics?
Well, I think that that will be for the nation's policymakers to decide, but I do hope that the work of the commission will be useful to them in making the very difficult decisions, I mean, really case by case, of how human rights fits in with so many other factors that have to be considered when you're framing foreign policy.
And to go back to something you said earlier, and it's something I think that was emphasized in one of the original discussions of the commission, you are focusing on, let me see if I get this distinction right, principles and not policies. Is that right?
That's right. I understand that there's a gray area, maybe a big gray area, but the State Department has plenty of people who are very good on policy.
Okay, let me ask one last question. I'd like to start where I began. I thought that the extraordinarily heated reaction to the announcement of your commission was remarkable. It reminded me how proprietary the certain progressive guardians of human rights are, and of how important and contested the question is of who defines these rights and who controls human rights. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. I found the reaction remarkable in its lack of open-mindedness and its rush to judgment, but I'm confident that the work of the commission will show that those who rush to judgment will be proved wrong. And I hope some of them will have the grace, when the work is done, to concede that they were wrong about what the commission would do. Meanwhile, I'm looking forward very much to collaborating with a remarkable group of men and women on what I hope will be a real service to our country and a real service to the cause of human rights for everyone.
I hope so too, and very good luck with your task.
Thank you, Jack.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. The Lawfare Podcast is produced by Jen Patia Howell, whose rights are inalienable. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan, who, being in Hong Kong, probably has alienable rights at this stage. You need to do your part with your unalienable rights to support the Lawfare Podcast. Use your unalienable right of free speech to tweet about it, to leave a review, to rate the Lawfare Podcast, to share it on Facebook. You can use your unalienable right to commerce, to purchase merch at the Lawfare store, www.thelawfarestore.com. And of course, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.